recently, and it must have been around February. I remember at the lake, it was nighttime, and there's this snowstorm outside, and we had these outside lights that shone all everything in woods, and there's a tremendous snowstorm, and the phone rang. And I took it and said, I'd like to speak to Harry Albers. I said, this is Harry. Said, Harry, this is Bob Nardelli at San Diego State University. I said, okay, what can I do for you? He said, your application for general manager position at the San Diego State University Foundation. And I said, Dr. Nardelli, I don't know anything about it. I've never heard of San Diego State University. I hadn't. And so we had one of those, what the heck, what could have happened here conversations.
Yeah.
And it turned out, we discovered during the conversation, there's one of these higher ed associations in Washington at DuPont Circle, which acts to help place people in positions. I've forgotten the name of it. But you send them your resume.
Mm-hmm.
Universities who are looking for people,
matching.
Yeah, go in. The organization is supposed to tell you, oh, we got a contact who we think is good for you, and they then send you a letter saying, can we release your mm-hmm. material to that organization?
Mm-hmm.
And if you say yes, then you get a contact. Well, it turned out that they had not contacted me about the SDSU contact. So I said, okay, well, let me hear about the job. So Bob told me, and we set up time for me to come out and interview. And I came out.
And you came to San Diego.
And I came to San Diego. And Jean came with me, of course.
Oh, boy, that's it.
I wasn't going to live anywhere. She didn't want me to live. And she fell in love with San Diego. It was like Tucson all over.
Right.
And had interesting experiences with the search committee of the board. Bob Nardelli was on it from education. And had some feisty board members. At that time, Brage Golding had left.
Mm-hmm.
Trevor
Colburn
was acting.
Right.
Never did meet him. He was traveling somewhere. I've forgotten who the chair of the search committee was. It may have been Bill Erickson, VP for... I don't know. But anyway, I interfaced with all these board members. I got introduced to Jim Cobble, but he was never around. I thought it was courtesy thing that I shook hands with them. And I did battle with the search committee, and when I say feisty, they were. They were in the middle of having just dealt with some huge deficit that the rehabilitation center had incurred, and they were incurring it. And one member of the board kept putting me in a position of, what would you do? And it was obvious he wanted an answer. I would get rid of the director or do something draconian, okay?
Yeah.
I don't know how you get rid of a tenured faculty member, but and Fred McFarlane was the director, who was a great guy. And I refused to be put in a corner, and I kept saying, mm-hmm. You haven't given me enough information.
Yeah.
And they didn't have enough information to get, so I just, and I figured I was through because I just wouldn't buckle.
Yeah.
So I got shown around and all sorts of good stuff. Met with all the staff of the foundation. They quizzed me. I wanted to know if I came. I said, would I change anything? And I said all the right things, true or not. But gave my overall philosophy of how I manage an organization.
Mm-hmm.
Not getting into, are you going to still have your job kinds of questions, which I didn't even know them. But the foundation was so different then.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I at the risk of insulting people, I termed it an accounting house.
Mm-hmm.
A faculty member or someone at the university would walk in, they had a program, some money, they needed a bank, they'd give it to the bank,
yeah.
Foundation would administer the funds. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with a grant. If some faculty member ginned up a proposal, then they would, you know, they're all totally reactionary. I mean, you react, you
yeah.
provide good service.
Yeah.
But that was it. I mean, that was all we've been told to do. That's all we do.
Very, very.
And I noticed on the first interview, there was a tug between administration and the academic side of the university.
Yeah, yeah.
Bill Erickson had very strong things to say about it because he had been a long-term director of the foundation before being vice president. Then Bob Benchoff took it.
Right.
And Bob was the general manager. And Bob told me he had gotten sick of being general manager. There was too much politics. I don't want to put words in his mouth. Mm-hmm. But there was something. He was no longer happy with the position.
Mm-hmm.
And so people were being interviewed. And so Bob once said to me, "Oh, I guess we need an astronomer now instead of an accountant." And I said, "I don't know, Bob." But he and I from day one had a wonderful relationship, as I did with the other major managers, Steve Bloom, Freya Sladek, and my assistant, Davian Gibson, who became my I don't know how to explain Davian, except she was always there. She was like Jiminy Cricket.
I've heard marvelous things about
her.
Yeah,
she was my Jiminy, my conscience, my Jiminy
everything.
Cricket. Anytime I made a decision she disagreed with, she would not let me go forward with it until I changed my mind. And I mean, she would stand her ground, couldn't budge her. She was usually right, which was good. But we started forming. And at that time, all the directors reported to me. There were about eight of them.
Well, wait, so you didn't expect this to happen? But it did happen.
Yeah, well, I went back after the interview, waited a long time. No one contacted me. I started calling Juanita Brentz, the foundation's personnel director, who was staffing the search committee. And I was finally told, no, a final decision can't be made because Brage Golding didn't meet you. So you have to come back out and meet Brage. I said, okay, fine. Come back out. San Diego State's different. Come back out to meet Brage. And and Jim Cobble, Al Johnson,
uh-huh.
Bill Erickson, and Brage Golding took me to lunch. There was some big crisis going on at the time, having to do with the chancellor's office, and I don't know what. I never understood. So I had lunch. I sat there, ate, listened to this for 2 hours. At the end, it was time to break up. Brage said, by the way, Harry, I'm Brage Golding. I shook hands. That was my meeting with Brage. Nothing more. Not one word more. So off I go back. Gene said, How'd it go?
Right.
I said, these people are insane. They fly me all the way out there to meet the acting president. He didn't give a damn about meeting me. And the three of them didn't talk about me. They were solving some problem, which I had no clue what they were doing. That was the meeting. So I went back, and a short time later, I got the call, and Jim Cobble called me. Because then I found out he was the chair of the board of the foundation, and which I didn't know, and because he was never there, and was behind the scenes doing everything. And at the same time, the new president was being hired, Tom Day. I mean, I got to San Diego State, I think, exactly a week before Tom did. And I all along, while I'm waiting to come out, I'm thinking, how are they going to hire me without me meeting Tom and him, Dr. Day? You know?
Mm-hmm.
Never occurred to anyone. It's fine with me. But funny thing happened. It must have been April-ish that finally they sent me a letter saying you're hired. And I told them, I said, well, my kids get out of school at the end of June.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't want to move out there until they can. And Barna's still paying me.
Yeah.
I'll let them keep paying me. And they were paying me more than San Diego State wanted to pay me. So I said, just as soon enjoy a few months of leisure.
Mm-hmm.
So during those few months of leisure, telephone rings. Again at night, University of Oklahoma. Harry, yeah. And it had been a thing where that through that agency I had previously approved them sending my... And then forgot about it, never heard anything.
Oh.
Harry, you're one of our three finalists for the vice president at the University of Oklahoma. And we really... And I told them... I said, unfortunately, I just accepted a job.
Mm-hmm.
And the man, I don't know who... I forget who he was, but he said something. He started giving more information than he normally would. I said, when did you take it? What's it about? And he said, you know, with your background in science and grants and contracts and the national centers and Smithsonian. We really want a financial VP who knows all that stuff. And we really want you. And he said, I can't say you, tell you you're our number one, but, I mean, it was clear. He was saying, unless you blow the interview, you're our guy.
Okay.
So he said, I really want you to come out. I said, okay. And so we started making flight. He's telling me what flight, where they wanted me, and they'd arrange the flights, and I'm making notes. And Gene wanders out to the porch where I'm doing all this and looking at it. And so I hang up. She said, what was that? And I'm all excited. Said, University of Oklahoma wants me to come out. And they sound like they really want me, Gene.
Uh-huh.
Said, no. Call them back right now. I said, what do you mean call them back? Said, you made a commitment. I said, screw the commitment. I said, you know, I haven't started there yet. I mean, they'll find somebody else. I want to do this. He said, no, you don't. You are not doing this. And so finally I had to call them back on the spot and tell them I couldn't do it.
So, that's interesting.
I could have been the vice president of University
but
of
But you would
Oklahoma.
Have been in Oklahoma, not San Diego.
That's true.
And Gene would have been in Oklahoma,
and
not San Diego.
That was probably, that may have been the point.
I think I got that.
So, that's how I wound up. And gosh, whenever we came, end of June sometime, we drove out in our two Volkswagens.
And that's 1978.
1978.
Yeah. And as you say, Tom Day had just come on. What fascinates me is, as you talk about the, I mean, Brage Golding was a chemist, an engineer and chemist. Tom Day is a physicist. I mean, all these people are scientists.
That's one of the key things that enable the foundation to be successful. Because our major thing was grants and contracts.
Right.
And when you're doing grants and contracts, if you want, I'm talking money now.
Right.
You want to make money, you want to make overhead money, indirect money, it's in science and engineering and health. It's not in education.
Right.
And at that time, education with a big grant, Tomas Arseniega, brilliant. And he and his faculty had some big grants, paid very little indirect money to operate the foundation, to give to the university.
Yeah.
And so here's Tom, a physicist, Al, a biologist.
Exactly.
Jim, a chemist, me, a
exactly.
physics, and we all had the same agenda.
That's what I see
as it started
and
developing.
And you fit, you know, I was thinking when you said they didn't talk to you, or, but I think that was part of what nobody said, but it might have been all about, too.
Yeah.
Because what you brought with you.
Yeah, and so it was clear to me that from day one.
Yeah.
Given how SDSU was set up, that its main ties had to be through the academic side of the house. I had to be accepted by faculty as one of them, by department chairs, by deans, and think they owned me if they wished to. And our foundation was just hell-bent on helping those academic colleges be successful,
right.
and stuff. And it was difficult because Bill Erickson, whom I loved working with, had such strong input, and the foundation up until that point, because of background, it seemed to me, I may be wrong, but it always leaned more towards the financial end, always making sure we never blew the budget, our audits were always clean, mm-hmm. Everything was on the up and up, and mm-hmm. the state can do most of our administrative stuff.
Hmm.
We didn't have to have our own department, this or that, to do it. Just the state will do it for us. And in my view, it was not a personality thing in any way. It was purely, how am I going to make this organization successful? And that's the charge the board was giving me.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim was giving me. He started getting really strong. And and that was my comfort zone, too. So,
right.
So I had to figure out how to keep Bill thinking we're doing a great job and being responsive to all his needs,
mm-hmm.
and at the same time doing it for Jim and Al on the other side. So that was a big, in the early years, a big challenge. Because the two were symbiotic to begin with. I mean, it was just a matter of putting them together the right way. They both, I had to rely on both of them. I needed both of them to be successful. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to. Whatever was going on, the tensions I sensed, I didn't want to add to them. I want to get rid of them. Mm-hmm. So.
I don't know. Whatever. But just go, because it's fabulous.
Okay. So arriving at the foundation, I had these challenges about how I worked with the university personnel, and that went pretty quickly. Everyone, if I made my case, I could usually get everyone to buy into it. If I couldn't get people to buy into it, we wound up in the president's office. I had a direct line to him, and he insisted on that. He was corporate-wise, he was the president of the corporation, I mean, in the bylaws. So I would meet with Tom once a month. Whenever there was some things that represented a change he should be aware of or an opportunity he should be aware of, I get on his calendar, and he was always gracious and wanted to hear about it, was interested. And if he, on the other hand, found out something that would hit the foundation, he'd call me over and say, "Harry, we got to do something about this." So I worked with all of the chief administrators, the vice presidents at that time, and was able to go where I want if I made my case strongly enough and presented it to the board. The board was interesting in that it was split in two. Half senior management of the university and half faculty. And then later, we started adding a few community members. I always worked well with the faculty people. They knew where my heart was, and I went out of my way to make sure they knew where my heart was and mm-hmm. that I was primarily interested in grants and contracts. And so the faculty usually supported me on things. When there were important questions, the vice presidents did also. Either I had convinced them, or if I didn't convince one or two of them, Tom would meet with them before the board meeting and convince them. So Tom was actively involved. But Jim was the smoothest chairman. We would do up agendas that were works of art. It gave you so much information. The board had a week to read it. Mm-hmm. Some of them did. Most of them didn't. So they listened carefully and asked questions. Mm-hmm. So we got just about everything we wanted. And as far as the foundation, what I saw immediately was we had to do better in grants and contracts. Now, the only way you do better in grants and contracts is by having strong graduate programs. Faculty who do research need graduate students to work with them.
Yeah.
No ifs, ands, and buts. So Jim Cobble was busy with setting up more cooperative doctoral programs with other institutions.
Right.
And he had a formula that was just miraculous. Mm-hmm. You know, he'd look at where was there an opportunity?
Mm-hmm.
And the factors that went into that were, well, CSU serving California's citizens and job creation, where are there holes? Where aren't there enough graduates? So that's number one. And then, are there grants and contracts available in that area mm-hmm. that we could go after?
Mm-hmm.
Can we hire top-notch faculty mm-hmm. to come into that? Can we be impressive enough so when we go over to UCSD, our area of research
right.
fits in, not competes, but augments
right.
the area of research at the other institution,
right.
and our faculty are as good as theirs, and they form relationships, and if that happens, we're in. Then it's just a matter of getting through all the state processes to do it. And so Jim just picked out one thing after the other.
Mm-hmm.
He told me where we were going next. It had been approved internally at the university. I had to come up with front money often, building space,
mm-hmm.
Something to use money to attract top-notch faculty here, augment
right.
their salaries somehow, give them space if the university couldn't provide it. The dean was always integrally involved in using state monies to whatever legal extent he or she could
yeah.
for salary money and for this or that. But it was a combination of state money and foundation money that could get these things rolling. We wanted all faculty to do all faculty, but I was after the science, engineering, health kind of things because of the indirect. If we really wanted to do things big time financially and augment resources. So we went systematically. I work hand in hand with Jim to get resources to put together so he can move forward. Now the other thing I needed was an organization that could really do the job. Up until then, while Freya was doing development, it was still the faculty person had to walk into the office. I said, no, I want you to be proactive. Mm-hmm. I want you to set up your organization so that you can both do what you have been doing, but you find opportunities. You go out, and you and your staff, a group of them we set separate, go out and bring these opportunities to the faculty aggressively. Talk to the dean, talk to the department chair, get them in bed, get them moving. And so her primary job became, it's marketing to me. She became my marketing department.
Yeah.
And she was really, really good at it. Mm-hmm. She could really work. She could talk faculty into almost anything. And it was amazing watching her work. Because we'd be at a meeting and she'd explain, and faculty or department, no, we can't do that. She'd stop. And she'd start all over again and say the same thing. And no, we can't. So I said, oh, okay, I understand. And she'd start the same thing. And she just, it was like erosion, you know. And so you'd talk to anyone into things. And so we really started moving out. To the point, a significant percentage of our work was coming in from things that we had brought to people's attention, and we had a really full-blown, developed an operation to get information from all the funding agencies. We sent our people back to the funding agencies to meet the program directors, tell them who we were, what our strengths were, what is coming up, what are your priorities, national priorities coming up, see how we can fit them together. And until that time, there was only, other than the education things, the rehab things were the big things, there was one faculty member in biology, Phil Miller. Mm-hmm. He was bringing in most of the indirect. And he had some, one of the country's, world's leading ecologists. He was starting up the science of ecology here. And our goal was to get as many Phil Miller type grants and Phil Millers as you possibly could. And tragic thing, early on, must have been early 80s, Phil was a health nut. His chief administrative assistant was his wife, Patsy, who was a terror. I mean, I say that in a good way, but she was always at the foundation raising hell about something. And we had converted one of the residences down along this bordering street into a biology lab for him because the university didn't have space. Phil went out jogging. He was eat nuts and stuff and joggle. Came back. We had a shower set up in his lab. He went and took a shower and had a heart attack and died. When it happened, I felt so bad for him and Patsy. I'd gotten to know them well. But I said, my other thought was, we're through. I mean, he's our star. We only had one star then.
Oh, my.
But one of his people who I think started as a graduate student, Walt O'Shell, assumed his grants, and Walt became quite famous in his own right and is still, I understand, very active and successful. So I had to do that. I had to build my team in the foundation and give them a new viewpoint that we weren't there just to wait for people to walk in the door. We're going to be aggressive and be out there. And I remember one meeting we had of the senior staff and my main lieutenants, and we had grown things from, I don't know, 10 million. Business to about 50, 60 or something. And I was putting forth goals for the near term, next year or two. And I said, we're going to hit 100 million. And I've forgotten how many years I said, but within the next 2 or 3 years, I expect.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody looked at me like I had lost my mind. They wanted to walk out. They didn't want to take on that. But we did. And other things started happening. The property stuff started happening because we needed professional property management just to manage all of the... what do you call it? A slum landlord property we owned. And that's all we owned. I mean, it was disgusting.
Really?
Because all these houses that ran on the border of the campus,
oh,
we just kept buying them and converting them to project space.
Oh.
And it was terrible. It was horrible space. But we had an opportunity. I think it was CFIRST, which is the operating arm of Seattle National Bank, back when called and said, oh no, they didn't start it. Two partners who owned the buildings at the Alvarado Center, they owned the buildings, not the land. The land was in a real estate investment trust that was overseen by Sal, oh God, what's the big entrepreneur who started what became Costco? Sal, it'll come to me. Very wealthy man. Those buildings were in bankruptcy in Seattle National Bank, CFIRST,
okay.
All the buildings. And there were three main ones. And the owners came and asked if we were interested in buying them. So I started talking to them. This would be a major upgrade for us to have space. And the price, they're in bankruptcy, so I got... They put me in touch with Seattle, with CFIRST, who held the mortgage. Started talking to them. CFIRST had this one man named Ed Ellsberg. Gosh, why did I remember that? Who was in the process. His sole job was handling all of their properties that were in bankruptcy and working them out of bankruptcy somehow, solving the CFIRST problems. And Ed and I became pretty close. I swear I called him every day for a year or more. And we started talking about how we could get the buildings. I thought, and the little I knew about real estate at the time, when you buy buildings, people tell you how much they want and you dicker and come to an agreement. Well, I had an acquaintance named George Goodman who I first met because of setting up the Hansen Institute. George is probably still a developer. And I told George my problem, and he laughed. I said, what's so funny? He said, you know, people in bankruptcy, you don't listen to what they tell you they want. You decide what you want to pay, and you make an offer. And I said, oh, that's how you do it. Okay. So I said, George, would you help me? I'll help you. So he met with the owners. Two owners, partners, and sized it all up. He and I and one of my staff went up. I don't know who it was. Maybe Freya, maybe Steve Bloom. Probably Bob Benchoff, who's my financial guy. Went up to CFIRST, found out what they owed on the mortgage and what would make CFIRST happy if we came in, because they wanted us to come in.
Mm-hmm.
They saw San Diego State University. They didn't know our foundation. They thought our foundation was as solid or impressive at that time as the university. You know, we get San Diego State University. So we went up and met with them, and George was fabulous. He said, look, if between us we can get the two owners,
mm-hmm,
to just walk away whole, not owing a cent to you, so you don't go after them for any money, other than we will pay what's left on the mortgage, period, which is like half price of what was owed. And CFIRST moaned and groaned and we kept after, and finally said okay, because they were losing every month. No, they weren't being paid anything.
Huh.
So we nailed it down at that, and then what happens? Dam National University decided it wanted the buildings to set up more of its operation there. So they put in an offer to CFIRST, too. And So we had to up the price to, because they CFirst didn't want National. They wanted us. Mm-hmm. So we had to come to a price which CFirst would accept and reject Nationals. And we still, it was still a killing for us. So we did that, and I think we got CFirst to put up the money to us. So we, there was an option in the land lease to purchase the land. So we got the deal with CFirst, plus we got a loan from them to buy the land. So the whole kit and caboodle was ours. And that was crisis time, because most of the buildings were empty. Mm-hmm. And we were just working our butts off getting anybody, not just projects, commercial tenant. And what happened was, I've never figured out if there was just a jump in grants and contracts that was going to happen anyway.
Oh.
Or the, because there was space available and faculty could see they could get some nice space, they went after grants that they otherwise, I don't know. Didn't care. But our business just started going up, and out of the indirect monies, we were able to pay off the our loans and make that thing go. And so then we started plucking the other buildings down there was until we got all of them. I mean, there were at least three or four other ones. Hmm. So we wound up with the whole center. And we were doing it both commercial projects, and then whatever is empty, leasing it to commercial tenants. And we got some good commercial tenants, too. So we made that go. Now, as we were going through this transition, we really had to upgrade our property development arm, mm-hmm. And really need some expertise, because we were dealing now with a couple of 100,000 square feet of space and everything.
Right.
So we got a new person in charge of that. We brought in a person who was expert in leasing, another person who was expert in design and mm-hmm. whatever the hell.
Yeah.
So suddenly, here we go from slum landlords to a highly professional staff to manage buildings. And I'll just stay with property, regardless of timing here.
No, that's fine.
So at one point in the, I don't know, I have to just guess on this. It was probably 84, 85.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Day called me over. He had just received a memo from the chancellor's office. It was one of those times when the state budget was going to hell again. And there was a memo saying, the chancellor's office, for the foreseeable future, going to fund student housing, new student housing. You should look to other sources of whatever to do it, whatever. It's up to you now. It's not on us.
Yeah.
So Tom looked. He says, anything here the foundation can do?
Mm-hmm.
I said, I don't know. Let me go look at it and mm-hmm. think about it. Because Tom wanted more student housing. So by this time, I had met developers. I had met this George Goodman.
Right.
Who was always a good friend. And Tim Considine, who was on our board as one of the first community members. Who's a man about town. He runs a big accounting CPA thing, well known. His wife owns the big Mexican restaurant over in, what's the island? My head stopped working.
On
the wealthy.
Shelter Island?
No.
Coronado.
Yeah. So I went to talk with Tim about it, and George, and Tim put the first idea in my head. So, Harry, Foundation wants to do something like student housing. He said, if you want to get into the development game, first thing you do is you never use any of your own money. You use other people's money. I said, how do you do that? So he took me through the thing. I said, new world again.
Mm-hmm.
So I talked to the board about it. Tom wanted to explore. So they gave me let me use enough money to do a marketing study to see what the commercial demand was, student housing in the area.
Hmm.
It was done by a young man then, Fred Pierce, who worked for the Goodkin Company. The marketing study came back all positives.
Hmm.
there was a pent-up demand, you could charge this much, but the housing would have to be such and such and such. Penitentiary kind of architecture rooms. Has to be like apartments, kitchens, like a condo. Mm-hmm. And what the design would be, what the density would be, and you got a captive audience. Mm-hmm. Damn, what do I do now? I talked about it again with my informal developer experts, and I said, well, next thing you need is another study, land planning study. There are firms that, once they've got the marketing data, use land planning study, actually do quantitative studies about density, kinds of buildings, all of this, architecture. So we hired the, put out an RFP, board said, go ahead, keep fooling around. Put out an RFP, got a lot of things back, and God, I can't remember the name of the firm, Hanson something. I have to look it up. Mm-hmm. Nice people, love them. Really seemed honest. Mm-hmm. I was finding a lot of people in the real estate world weren't. I was working with all good people, my experts and the marketing people and the land planning. They took a year, I don't know, did a land planning thing. It involved, I'm going to say hundreds of community meetings. See what the community would buy in. So I'm suddenly involved in...
Oh, boy.
That crap. Excuse me. I mean...
I understand.
hired a woman. No, we had hired her already for PR, but she became my community... She lived in the community. She was always in the community, meeting with the people, knew them, always having lunch with them.
I mean, she was from the community.
She was from a... what kind of a PR firm in town.
Okay.
I'm just saying, she essentially, all her working hours were pretty much spent out in the community, knowing all the people, all the problems.
Right.
And she just gave me invaluable, her name was Stephanie Boyd, she just gave me invaluable information. So we got the land planning study, and it was all positive. I said, oh, geez. Looks like we got something going here. I've now got two studies. I've got a professional real estate staff. Mm-hmm. We have to now do the big step. We got to get a developer, and we got to get the developer to use his money, not our money. I'm not risking the foundation's assets. I told the board this on and on. Let me use money for studies. I will tell you every cent, but I'm never going to risk foundation major assets unless I come to you with a specific proposal. And I'm hoping not to. So we put out an RFP, and a local development firm headed by Chris McKellar, a wonderful family. Chris is an extraordinary person. He's part of the one of the big families in La Jolla. He or his father had done the whole UCLA college town thing. What's it called? Do you know? But there's a thing. My brain is getting tired. And got to know Chris and his people. They had $2 million just sitting in their corporation. And Chris wanted to do a landmark project for the McKellar Company for San Diego State. He just wasn't the mercenary developer. Mm-hmm. Chris put together a team of, there must have been 30 expert consultants to plan out the project.
Wow.
And came up with a plan. I mean, he had a leading architect. He had a leading everything. I mean, and it was a hell of a team. And we put in enormous amounts of time in. Got to know the thing inside out. Chris took us to Harvard to see what Harvard Real Estate Group was doing. We all wandered around. I mean, it was fun working with a private developer. Here we are out in Harvard Square with champagne glasses and champagne and looking at everything, and my staff and I. And so how are we going to finance that? And so we had to get really into that. And again, when we did this, there was an upturn in the market. And then,
another down.
Chris had to pull out. Just donated all the work to us. Mm-hmm. No strings attached. Mm. Just
fantastic.
I know. Incredible man. Hmm. I think he's part of the Scripps family.
Oh.
So he was out, and it was a loss because Chris had a heart. He was smart. God, I wanted to work with him, but their business got to a point they couldn't. We put out another RFP, mm-hmm. and an outside LA group again with I can't think of their name, but they gave us a dynamite proposal. They were going to get outside financing, do this, that. Mm-hmm. They went bankrupt when we're a year into the project.
Yeah.
So what do we do? Experts are telling me we shouldn't ditch it. By this time, Tom loved the idea. We had made a big presentation up at the chancellor's office. Ann Reynolds was chancellor then. She loved the idea. In a big meeting of the trustees, she announced to all of them, I wish all our other campuses were as entrepreneurial as this, and gave us lots of kudos. We finally figured out ways that Fred Pierce, who was the marketing person, mm-hmm. young man, mm-hmm. in the meantime had transitioned off to an LA development firm that put in a bid to be the developer. We didn't like their owner too much that Fred worked for. And Fred had subsequently left, so I called Fred and said, hey, how'd you like to come work for us? Mm-hmm. As kind of an in-house developer, but we had an outside firm. I need an in-house expert who knows the business. And Fred really knows financing. Mm-hmm. So Fred came to work for us. And some kind of arrangement where it was his company, even though the company was him, just him. And I said, fine, we'll pay you so much. And Fred and the rest of us, he put together a way to see our way through tax-exempt financing, issuing bonds, in which we're able to use what we build as the collateral and to go ahead with the project. Hmm. And all we had to risk was the land, which we owned, on which the things would be built. We put that at risk. Otherwise, we felt we could make it go. And we were all set to do it. And we did the first project was all the fraternity houses down there. So that was the foundation's project. That went well. So we're ready to bite the bullet, go the big time now, do the student housing part. When Tom, it was about the time Tom was retiring. All I can say after that, being kind, is that it became a mess.
Oh.
And with all kinds of politics and who knows what, which essentially put the project in jeopardy. I resigned about that time, too, to do something else, which came my way with a group of companies, which I don't know. Have you heard anyone told you about the Foundation for Math and Science Education? I did that. From the time I left the foundation, I set up this new foundation at the three companies asked me, Qualcomm, AMCC, and one of the, what was the computer company that had the cow as its main marketing symbol? It was one of the big ones. They were in the chips then. They later didn't do too well. But it was at that time one of the big PC companies. All three of those, I won't get into this now or ever, but all three of those companies wanted to do something to help San Diego Unified School District. And they were willing to put up, each of them, $1 million a year for so many years. And then I would work with San Diego Unified. I would set up this new foundation, mm-hmm. which I did by using the SDSU Foundation as our administrative device. And I just had a staff of three, Dean being one. and he called it the FIMSI organization, with a board of SDSU people, mm-hmm. the company, the funding people, and the San Diego Unified District. And I affiliated it with the university's CRIMSI department, which is, in this country, one of the leading combinations of College of Ed and College of Sciences group of faculty who specialize in education, mm-hmm. teacher education, kid education.
Yeah.
So we got a whole new thing going, and we later brought in, with the help of Alan Burson, was the superintendent. We wound up with grants from Bill and Melinda Gates, the Atlantic Foundation, and Hewlett-Packard Foundation, in the tens of millions. And then we got a big grant from the NSF, so we were all kinds of money to teach San Diego Unified teachers how to teach math, to bring them up to where they could teach it. So SDSU CRIMSI department was running all these courses where Unified District teachers could get everything from short courses to master's degree courses to you name it, any kind of training they needed, intensive math courses. And it was great for the teachers. It brought them their skills way up, and they got promotions back at Unified for getting new degrees and new certificates. And so our FIMSI thing I did for about 4 years, and then I retired for real. I turned that one over. So that ends my property discussion anyway. A huge opportunity was missed, to the point, if I go back now, with what we had accomplished in grants and contracts, what we had were doing with all our special programs, how successful they were being, not through us, but through the staff and the PBS and the extended studies and everything, but us being the agency to handle the monies and do everything. And we'd make money off that. And now the property, which gave us an opportunity in the future to make so much money, we would have easily passed the university's state budget, in 5 years. At most, we would have. It was, and again, all of the money is to give to the university, to keep priming the pump.
Yeah.
So that was that. But we opened up another big area, too, of funding. For about 10 years, I would spend time every year at the University of Hawaii's Institute for Astronomy. I did a sabbatical there. They asked me to come over. The director of their Institute for Astronomy was a close friend of mine. I'd worked with him many places. And he asked me to come over, and I was essentially the Institute's management guru. Mm-hmm. I would come over every year, at least a month, 6 weeks in the fall. They had an office for me. I would fool around, meeting with all the faculty, meeting with all the staff, doing things to get the place, where the director and I wanted it, and lots of things. There were at one time huge faculty problems, and I kind of had meetings where everybody could let their hair down and do this and become a team and do whatever. While I was over there, one of the years, and we always got a high-rise condo right on Waikiki Beach, but it was wonderful. Mm-hmm. While I was there, the director, Don Hall, was working, and I helped him a little bit, but not much. There was another source of funding I had been aware of for universities. Unkind people call it pork. I call it appropriations. But Hawaii, for the longest time, has had Senator Daniel Inouye, who's been the chief Republican on various appropriation committees in the Senate. And the amount of money that will go to Hawaii, including to the university, through these special appropriations mm-hmm. that were put in the bills after the fact amazing. I think a good part of Hawaii's economy is, through all the DOD establishments and the appropriations and everything else, the university benefits. I said, my God, you can actually make money by working with your congressman. Ah. And finding where you can fit in a national priority. Mm-hmm. And if your congressman is positioned correctly on the right committees, and he's really, or she is really interested in your project, mm-hmm. for your state, for your constituency, you can do good things. So I came back and I said, Freya, get yourself to Washington and find out who the lobbyists are, I want to really explore this. And so she did. She came back and said, guess what? I said, what? So Bill Lowry, who had been the congressman who represented the university for a long time,
right,
was just joining a lobbying firm.
Oh.
And she met with Bill and said, Bill, bend over backwards to do good things for us if we became his first client. So we went with Bill. Mm. And we started doing programs. The first one we did, I think it was the first one, we had several, we started because at the time, again, it must have been late 80s, early 90s, a bad economic time for San Diego.
Yes.
And the military and the defense companies were all laying off large numbers of highly skilled people.
Right.
Jerry Lewis, who's a senior Republican congressman from California, from Redlands, mm-hmm. was really interested, he sat on the Appropriations Committee, mm-hmm. was really interested in doing something, not just for Redlands, but for California, about all of this loss of talent that was going to occur. So Bill and Jerry told us, you can come up with a top-notch defense conversion plan to retrain these people.
Right.
We'll listen. Jerry would listen and see what the committee thought about it. Oh, man, did we put a proposal together. We'd put the deans together, everybody. And the thought was we would set up programs where these people who had been working in the defense industry weren't used to the other new industries, that computing and
right.
everything.
Right.
Their skill set wasn't there. We would retrain them.
Yeah.
In the departments. Again, with everything from yeah. short courses to master's, PhD, bachelor, anything mm-hmm. you need. The program was incredibly successful.
Wonderful.
I can't say how many, but I think it was 90-some percent that we placed. I may be wrong, but it was so high that it was unexpected.
That's fantastic.
And we just kept getting money coming in. And so deans had, and department chairs had the ability to convert obsolete labs into new teaching facilities in their buildings, to bring in other faculty, to do all sorts of stuff, to retrain these really talented people. And every year we'd have a big graduation ceremony. I think Jerry came out to some of them. Mm-hmm. Other congressional people would come to them. It was just a great success. So we got in the appropriation business and had other areas too. So here was another new source of which we could take some overhead and indirect on and make money on to be used with the university. So it was another source of revenue that colleges were beginning to trip to, mm-hmm. and we thought we should be part of it, even though there was a lot of controversy about getting these non-competed grants, as people called.
But it's just this amazing story of so much growth and creative insight. It's very exciting.
So it was fun.
Very exciting, and it's. Shows, I mean, how you led this, the foundation is so important in the university and knowing what's going on within the historical context, as you said, of the need to bring new skills to these
yeah.
people, and all about continuing to innovate in education.
Yeah, so it was wonderful, very satisfying. But remember, we had developed a great management team. I mean, we were really good. I was usually or often the idea person, mm-hmm. but then I'd give it to Freya or Steve or Bob or whatever or someone to pull off. I mean, to do. I always like to keep myself free so I could have fun and let the staff do a lot of the work. But they're good. I mean, we had a great, really good team.
That's really great. No. I'm not trying to. I just whatever. Okay. This is good. Okay.
This is getting long, but I have to talk about the Hansen Institute that we set up. Back in my first few years at the foundation, sometime probably 1980-ish, I'm not sure, the fellow I've spoken about previously, George Goodman, who's a developer in town, wandered into my office. It's my first time I ever met with him. And wanted to have a conversation. All he would tell me was that he represented the trustee of an estate who had some money and was looking for ways to carry out the trust's objectives, the goals of the man who had left the money, the words that were in his will. The man who left the money was named Fred J. Hansen, from a San Diego family. Many of them are now the Cady family, C-A-D-Y, and I work in particular with Ron Cady, a grandson of Fred, and Rose Cady, Ron's mother and Fred's daughter. Anyway, George Goodman said he's working with an attorney who's the trustee on how to get recommendations how to spend the monies. And the only directions in Mr. Hansen's will was that it was Mr. Hansen's belief that if peoples from countries with hostility towards one another could be brought together somehow to interact, that would accomplish his goal of making a contribution to world peace. So that was all George told me. He wouldn't tell me the trustee's name. And he said he was going around to other universities and other organizations and seeing we're supposed to be the bright people in town at universities. Who's creative enough to come up with this? So I started up conversations at the university. We came up with many ideas, and none of them seemed to impress George from the other institutions as well. George became aggressive then himself. Instead of depending upon me to perform a miracle for him, one day he came into my office with an SDSU faculty member, Bob Antel, who was a retired professor of sociology. And he introduced me to Bob and said Bob had some ideas, and he had some ideas with Bob about what we might do. It was a time not too far after the Camp David Accords, where Anwar Sadat and who was the Prime Minister of Israel then?
I just went blank.
The short, it'll come to me, had formulated their agreements on
Perez or Shamir?
No. Neither of those.
Barak.
Anyway, whoever was at the Camp David Accords, I think it was Jimmy Carter of the U.S. They had agreed that the agreement had been that there would be peace between Israel and Egypt.
Right.
And so that was their starting point. And also, and we decided, why don't we send Bob to Egypt and Israel just to scout around, meet with whoever he felt he could see, to see if there was any opportunity to bring Egyptians and Israelis together.
Mm-hmm.
Bob was a very creative, lovely, wonderful man, and off he went. while he was in, I believe it was Israel, he came across another man on a similar mission. His name was Bob Abel. He was affiliated with the New Jersey Consortium of Oceanographic Universities, something or other. And Bob was trying to do something similar. Bob had information that in the Foreign Aid Bill of AID, that Senator Henry Waxman had put $5 million in the Foreign Aid Bill to help implement the Camp David Accords. So Bob, being in oceanography, has contacted Egyptian oceanographers and marine science people and Israeli scientists, and he had a cadre of American scientists in the field, Summit Scripps Oceanographic Institute. Bob had no money. He had identified these people who had volunteered to get together, and Israel and Egypt seemingly had given permission for the people to meet and work out some scientific program. Nothing, it couldn't be political. So Bob was wondering how he could accomplish something. Bob Abel, that is. Bob Antel came back from the meeting, spending a lot of time with Abel. And I guess it was probably Antel who had the idea. I don't remember. Said, why don't we present this to George Goodman? And by then we had learned the name of the trustee, who's a local attorney named Leo Henriksen, Rick Henriksen, we called him, who was the man with the money. Mm-hmm. And so we met with George and Rick, presented the idea. How about if you give us Hansen money, we'll fund the conference for Bob Abel so that Bob will have the ability to bring Israeli and Egyptian and Americans together to plot out some program. Hmm. The trustee liked it, gave us an allocation. Bob Antel, me, Freya, Davine, others staffed the thing, set up the meeting, which was here in San Diego. I believe we held it at the Hilton on Mission Bay. Mm-hmm. And so here we were. Now remember, this is a long period of time where Egyptians and Israelis had not worked together.
Right.
Only politicians on the highest level had been meeting occasionally. No one else. And here we were hosting this meeting in San Diego for the first time with other than senior politicians. We were told by both Egypt and Israel that it had to be a tight security, hush-hush, no publicity thing. We had Israel's security, the Mossad, on hand. Mm. They were pointed out to us. They were identifiable by the fact that it was, as I recall, summertime, and they were sitting around the pool in thick wool suits with bulges in their jackets. So we set all the scientists up in the hotel. Interestingly enough, it was very, very tough getting them to get together. And we had an initial evening. Couldn't have been a cocktail party because Egyptians didn't drink, so fruit juice and whatever, hors d'oeuvres. And we had thought through pretty carefully how to make this work and knew it might be a resounding flop. Americans, we brought all the Americans who came, including university administration, we brought our wives. And it turned out that the wives were the icebreakers. Both parties were more than willing to talk with the wives, not so willing to talk with one another, and the women became matchmakers, as well as our staff.
How wonderful.
Of course, but It was a revelation, unexpected. And the meeting went off well to the point We kept everyone there a few days and hammered out a proposal, which Bob Abel, as the administrator, submitted to AID and got a $1 million grant from AID to run the program. We said, aha, we're not dumb. So some of us went back to Egypt and Israel to meet people, to find out what other programs could possibly, if another program could be put together, that we could follow the formula, and we would be the administrators, not someone else at another organization.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the oceanographic program was interesting in that the participants insisted it was not a trilateral program. It was a mutual bilateral program. We're getting into diplomacy here. That the Egyptians agreed to work with the American scientists, and the Israelis agreed to work with the American scientists, and the American scientists would be the interface between the Egyptians and the Israelis. So all of the people, the Egyptians and Israelis, all had a fig leaf if they were ever ran in, particularly the Egyptians, if they ran into trouble back home working directly with Israelis,
yeah.
They could say absolutely not. So this was a fundamental premise that the program was built on. We wanted to take it a step further, so in our explorations, we decided it had to be a trilateral program. We really wanted to see the parties cooperating directly and not just through American scientists. On the trip, I don't think I was on the first trip. I think Bob Antel was, I think maybe George Goodman was on it. Maybe Rick Henriksen, too. I don't really recall. But they ran into a gentleman named Samuel Pohorilis, who was a professor at Tel Aviv University, but also a senior advisor. His expertise was in agriculture and agricultural economics in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked directly with Shimon Peres, who was the foreign minister at that time.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And so the team made the connection with Pohorilis, who quickly got them, I believe on that visit, or may have been a later visit, an introduction with Shimon Peres,
mm-hmm.
who has always been pushing peace programs in the Middle East.
Right.
Is an incredible, brilliant, courageous man. In Egypt, they met up, and so Pohorilis said, both our governments, Egypt and Israel, have been given a mandate to work together on agriculture programs. That's the area Egypt and Israel would consider doing trilateral programs, because who could argue with we're going to work together on programs that are going to benefit both countries economically,
mm-hmm.
And feed our people.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't be better than that. In Egypt, the team met with Youssef Wali, who was the Minister of Agriculture. He also happened to be, if not at that time, a short time later, Deputy Prime Minister of Egypt. So it was a close relationship there directly with President Mubarak. And we found out that Wali and Pohorilis had been in contact trying to figure out what kind of programs the two countries could do. And here come these Americans saying, we'd like to interest you guys in doing a program like this. So we were the innocents abroad. And conversation led to conversation. Dr. Wali appointed a professor at En Shams University, Adel El Beltagi, as the Egyptian contact. Adel was also a high official in the Ministry of Agriculture and worked directly for Dr. Wali. Sam Pohorilis in Israel pointed us to Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. Mm-hmm. And in particular, a man named Yoel Schechter, who was the head of their Arid Lands Institute. Yoel was both scientist and administrator. The real scientist there was a wonderful man named Dove Pasternak, who was appointed by Pohorilis to be the chief Israeli contact for all science. Pohorilis would be the political contact. So in Israel, Dove put together a team of top-notch experts in arid land agriculture. In fact, these people were some of the best in the world in the field. Mm-hmm. In Egypt, Adel el-Beltagi put together a similar team, the best Egyptian scientists, again, some of the top scientists in the world. They agreed to come to the United States, and we held another meeting. I believe, again, it was at the Hilton, and we had invited, since SDSU doesn't have a school of agriculture, we invited U.S. experts from UC Davis, mm-hmm. I can't remember where, University of Arizona, a few other universities. In addition, we had some of our faculty, like Walt O'Shell, who were in ecology, who were interested. So we had some of our faculty who were interested in the program as observers and hopefully contributors. Al Johnson was certainly a contributor. And Al became an integral part of our Middle East programs.
Right.
So we had the meeting. And it, much similar to the oceanographer, we had to do the ice breaking. The wives, again, were brilliant. Through the leadership of Beltagi and Pasternak, scientifically, the people got into incredible scientific discussions. Dr. Wally himself came to the meeting, which floored us. I mean, this was essentially Mubarak's personal representative. Egyptians are gentlemen. Dr. Wally was really agitated. He told me privately that Samuel Pohorilis didn't come to the meeting. These were the two people who were in charge of the political connections between the two countries.
Mm-hmm.
Dov Pasternak and the Israelis made all kinds of excuses, and we got around that. You have to know that some of these participants had family members who had been killed.
Oh, yeah.
In the war between the two countries. I mean, it was a very, very personal thing.
I understand.
The Egyptians were incredibly courageous for coming. Back home, people who worked with Israel were sometimes killed. It was all hush-hush.
Mm.
We had the local police involved. We had the local FBI involved. Davine and I did. Davine Gibson, who was my longtime assistant and my forever friend, and I did some serious planning about security. We worked with the FBI and the police, and we placed everyone in the hotel far away, no groups together. We all had them separated. Which was interesting after the meetings all ended, when the head of the Israeli Mossad team came to us and identified himself, asked us if we wanted some feedback on how we had done security and whatever. And they said, of course. So he said, everything was great, you know, except for one thing. He said, what was that? He said, it is absolutely necessary when you do things, you don't separate everyone in the hotel. You put them in one block.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. No, it wasn't that. It was, he came together, he said, you were brilliant putting everyone far apart. And we accepted his congratulations. And afterward, Davine and I kind of chuckled about the fact that we tried to put everyone together, but the hotel couldn't do it, so that's why they were separated.
That's funny.
So I almost ruined the story. So the meetings went from the point of tentative contacts So by the time the week ended, the participants were taking out pictures of their families, exchanging addresses, exchanging telephone numbers, promising to send papers to one another, keeping in touch.
What a success.
Yeah, we kept everyone there. We wrote up the proposal. Frey and her group got it written up with the scientists. We submitted it to AID, and we got it funded, much to our shock and, what, good Lord, what do we do now? We got the program rolling, had many meetings consisting of the findings among the scientists. We had a steering committee meeting, more frequent steering committee meetings, which we would have all over the world. We couldn't at first meet in Egypt because the Israelis weren't welcome at first. Some of the Egyptians wouldn't go to Israel, so we would have most of our meetings in European cities, where Dr. El Beltaghi from Egypt, they had the equivalent of agricultural consulates, that's the only way I could describe it, in practically every place in Europe. And he'd pick out a wonderful location where everyone would want to go. And not only would the meetings be fruitful, but we'd also have field trips to the agricultural facilities in those countries that the scientists wanted to see and explore, and bring in some other scientists from other countries. So these meetings were wonderful. We were the administrators. Al Johnson and I were the steering committee members for the U.S. Mm-hmm. Sam Pohorilis and Dov Pasternak for Israel. Adel El Beltaghi and Mr. Dasuki, who was a senior official at the Ministry of Agriculture, who was in charge of the Ministry of Agriculture's diplomatic enterprises. So that was the group that got together on a regular basis to plan out strategies, how the program should go. And we called the program CALAR, the Cooperative Arid Lands Research Program. We wound, my goodness, it must have gone for 10 years, in which we had whole areas of the deserts in Egypt and Israel in bloom with new technologies on how to grow, to develop plants genetically that like the desert climate. So we developed the plants. We found out how to fertilize the plants through great systems where everything was drip irrigation, where fertilizer and water were delivered to each plant, and something they coined the name fertilization, all computerized. And we enlisted the local farmers an extended studies program for local farmers with our scientists teaching them. So all of the everything we learned was being implemented by local farmers in Egypt and Israel, and literally hundreds, thousands of acres were in bloom with this. We also had, interestingly enough, an animal component of developing genetically the best sheep and goats to graze in the desert, and what kind of plants for them, because the Bedouin in the regions overgrazed the desert, and our scientists took that on, and we had Bedouin integrated into the again as kind of an extension kind of way. I had one wonderful experience in the Negev desert where we were invited out to meet with the Bedouin chief and his tribe in this enormous tent with the most wonderful carpets we sat on, piled deep one upon the other, the women fully clad serving us, and these beautiful children in their highly colorful clothes who herded the sheep, particularly the girls. And I found out why, when you look out in the desert and see flocks of goat and sheep, and the kids are in these incredibly bright colored clothes, it's so the adults could keep an eye on them.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was something funny going on while we were at this lunch in the desert and doing all of our speechifying. We found out that the night before, or several nights before, the son of the Bedouin chief was married in a great ceremony in that right there. That at the end of the ceremony, everyone was shooting off rifles, and the son was killed accidentally. So it was you run into things working in an academic environment you don't expect to run into.
Well, certainly so. This is just amazing. Yeah. Let me put
it.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay. One of the interesting things that happened, we formed such close relationship with Shimon Peres that when Steve Weber was inaugurated president, we had invited Shimon to come and accept an honorary doctorate at the ceremony, which he most graciously did. I was hosted him the whole time from the airport and stayed with him through everything. He was here several days. And I remember in particular after he was awarded the degree and the robe, we got back, he and I went, it was done in then Cox Arena, I don't know what it is, Sequan now or whoever it is, the basketball arena. We went back to the dressing area and he took off his new robe and everything that had been put on him and just put down on the seat, and we started leaving. I said, Minister Perez, you've forgotten your... He said, oh, no, he says, I have a collection of them. I don't need another. And I said, well, you mind if I keep it? And he said, of course not. So it's hanging in my closet at home.
Oh, how nice. Oh, what a great story. Well, this is just the most amazing story.
Yeah. So we had the KLR program with all these successes. AID in Washington was rabid about it. They loved it. So that when Egypt and Israel called me, Pohorilis called me. He had just spoken with Minister Wally. He called me from Israel on a regular basis, or woke me up in the middle of the night. And said, Harry, another opportunity. And I said, great, what is that? He said, Minister Wally wants to develop a farm in the north of Egypt, near outside Alexandria, because one of the programs the country has is they don't know what to do with their college graduates. They have too many college graduates. And many of them are becoming farmers. There are opportunities. So we want a model farm set up in near Alexandria, and they want us, San Diego State, to do our thing, get the people together, have a meeting, submit a proposal to AID, and set up the farm. So we did. We got it funded. It became the Mariut Project in Egypt, with Israeli and American participants. And it was an extension thing with farmers from all over the North Coast coming and able to get seeds, seedlings, expertise, fertilizer, whatever they needed, and to be trained to start up farms in the desert. And the water source was the runoff from Nile water that had been used to irrigate crops in the Delta, and there were these huge supplies of drainage water, and it was higher saline content, but here we were developing salt-tolerant plants and salt-tolerant procedures. So now we had two programs rolling and being successful. A couple of years later, my good friend Sam Pohorilis called me again, said, Harry, great news. I'm dreading the rest. Said, Morocco wants to make an opening with Israel. We've told them about the KLAR and the Marriott programs. They would like to do a similar program, but since there's no peace treaty between the two countries, it has to be done with a private sector in Morocco, and Israeli and American scientists. And we said, good grief. So we worked on it again with our close friends, Adel Beltagi and Dov Pasternak, the chief Israeli and Egyptian scientists, and decided, oh no, I'm sorry, Israel, Egypt was not involved in this one. This was just Israel-Morocco.
Mm-hmm.
And Dov Pasternak was, again, was the brains of what to do. He took a trip over to Morocco. He somehow had to have a fake passport to get into the country.
Right.
he met with André Ajoulay, who was the chief advisor to the king, Hassan. I believe it was Hassan. Hassan II, yes. Ajoulay introduced Dov to a private businessman who had an American Caterpillar franchise in Morocco, in Casablanca.
Mm-hmm.
Dov came back from the exploration and met with us and said, what Morocco needs more than anything is a seedling industry. I said, what is a seedling industry, pray tell? Well, Morocco spent enormous amounts of money buying seeds from European and Israel, interestingly enough, without any publicity. They had no seed-generating industry themselves. They had to buy seeds at high cost, develop them into seedlings, and then plant them. And Dov said what they had to do is replicate what he had in Israel, and which Ben-Gurion University had developed in developing crops, getting the seed and saving some of the seeds, having machines that can plant the seeds, grow the seedlings in huge quantities, using assembly lines with seedling machines, as he called it. In any case, we did it. And so now we had a third program, this one Israel-Morocco, and we were dealing directly with André Ajoulay, this chief advisor, and Shimon Peres on this one, and Israel felt this was a very important breakthrough for the two countries. It was interesting because we always had to maintain our identity at San Diego State as honest brokers.
Mm-hmm.
The Egyptians always wanted to make sure we weren't some tool of Israel.
Yeah.
So we had to show how independent we were. That we, when critical decisions came at our steering committee meetings, we made the final vote. The Americans did, after listening to everything.
Mm-hmm.
And believe me, it's an interesting war of cultures, and I use that word advisedly, when you have cultures like Egyptians and Israelis. Israelis are the hardest, meanest bargainers I've ever come in contact with. Even at their university, colleagues and the faculty, they'll stab one another in the back as soon as they look at one another, and it's part of doing business. There's no hard feelings. I mean, that's the level of their politics. Whereas Egyptians are the ultimate gentlemen.
Mm-hmm. It's a totally different.
It's almost impossible for them to ever say no to anyone. They tell you no by saying yes in a certain way, which
mm-hmm.
you have to be alert to. And it took all the Americans a while for this. We also had some major crises. When we finally got a major group of Egyptians to visit Israel for the first time, a reporter from the Jerusalem Post found out about the visit, wrote this long article about how senior Egyptians were on the political level and agricultural were here to learn from the Israelis how to do all this desert agriculture. And we, at the time, she printed the article all of us, all the Egyptians, Israelis, Americans, were staying in the Desert Inn in Beersheba in Israel. Mm-hmm. And at 3 in the morning, a loud knock on my door. And it was Dove. What's happening? He said, the Egyptians have all packed their suitcases and are leaving for the airport. Mm-hmm. I said, what happened? He explained it to me. They've been insulted. They're mm-hmm. not here learning. They're here as full participants. I was able to get Sam Pohorilis, he lived in Tel Aviv, on the phone, told him the situation, met with all the Egyptians, told him to settle down. I said, give me a few hours. You can't make your plane yet anyway. And Sam got the reporter, hustled her out to Beersheba, briefing her all the time, where Sam and the reporter made their apologies. The reporter was wonderful, telling that she just misunderstood. She was already starting to write another story, setting everything straight.
Great.
And thank goodness all the Egyptians went back to bed.
Wow. That is a phenomenal story.
Okay. Oh, another quick story. again, it involves a 3 in the morning or so phone call, probably from Sam Pohorilis. We were scheduled to leave for somewhere, I don't remember, in Europe for one of our steering committee meetings, or Israel, or maybe even Egypt, when the phone rang. I was going to leave that, be getting up in just 2 or 3 hours to head for the airport when the phone rang, and I'm pretty sure it was Sam Pohorilis. I said, Harry, the meeting's off. I said, oh, good grief, what happened? He said, Israel has just bombed the Arak nuclear facility, and the Egyptians have told us they will not meet. So I said, oh, my God, what about our program? He said, we'll let you know. He said, I have to speak with Minister Wally. I don't know how many days later Sam called me and said, Egypt and Israel are not breaking off country-to-country agreement, the peace treaty, but there is going to be a period of the cold peace, as it was called. And the program that they're going to keep open is the KLAR program. And I think, I never confirmed we were the only program that
wow.
they kept working on mutually, but that was my impression, and maybe I'm being overly proud.
No, but that's wonderful.
Yeah.
That's just wonderful.
One other thing, I won't go into it. I also, for a period of, I don't know, 3 years or something, Tom Day asked me to do the vice presidency of SDSU and the development
right.
relations. That was interesting because we had a shoestring operation, the university did at that time. And if it was going to ever get into the big time, it needed a substantial organization. So we were able to, I refused to step down as head of the foundation. That was my true love. Tom twisted my arm to do the other thing in university relations and development. But we were able to work with everyone throughout the university and set up a structure that other universities use, get the deans involved, hiring fundraising officers in each college, having a magazine and developing the magazine, changing the annual fund, doing all sorts of things which put the university for the first time on a footing to really go out and raise some substantial amounts of money. It was fun participating in all of that. And again, I had some great people working with me on that program, particularly the development officers in the college. And we had fun putting that all together. I think that concludes SDSU.
Tell me more about what's happened since then.
I started devoting more time to my family, which everyone says when they retire. But I mentioned that early on, even when I was in my English major phase, I started writing books. And I have a few. One is called, my latest one, The Discovery. And it draws on my, it's a mystery thriller. It draws on my astronomy background. I keep up on what's happening in the universe. The first one I did was a mystery called Murder at Lake Tomahawk, which was modeled on my experiences at Lake Hopatcong, New Jersey.
Wow.
So I do that, and I'm still writing. I have another one that I'm editing right now.
Terrific.
And in addition to that, I am a major resource at picking my grandkids up at their schools. I have four. Dustin Albers is a freshman at San Marcos State University. He's one of my best friends. He's having a marvelous experience. He's in the San Marcos equivalent of SDSU's Freshman Success Program. And I feel like I'm a freshman again in college. I helped him move into his dorm. He comes down most weekends. He takes me through all his coursework. I get to read his papers. So I'm having a wonderful time. His sister is named Bailey Albers. She's a sophomore at West Hills High School in Santee. She is a gorgeous redhead. She is a basketball player who last year, a nationally ranked service, this was when she was graduating eighth grade, and ranking kids who are going to start playing high school basketball, she was ranked something like 13th in California and 20th in the country. She's a starter already on the West Hills team, and she's mean as the devil when she's out on the court and just a joy otherwise. They're the kids of my youngest son, Steve. My oldest son, Harry, also has two children. Harry's a physician at internal medicine at Scripps. His wife Anna is also a doctor of internal medicine at UCSD. Hmm. Harry graduated, all of my sons graduated from SDSU. Harry graduated number two in his graduating class at SDSU. His lowest grade in his 5 years here was an A-, which he got because he took a honors English program in his freshman year, and the professor, who I'd like to name but won't, gave him his only A minus, and when Harry asked him about it, he told Harry he never gives anything higher. Mm-hmm. So he came out number two. He went to UCSD Medical School and did his residency there. Mm-hmm. In addition to his practice at Scripps Clinic, takes care of the Padres. Scripps has the contract to do all the medical work for the Padres. He's the senior internal medicine doctor and gets to spend a lot of time with the Padres. Son number two, Robert, is a sergeant in the San Diego Lifeguard Service. He also is a graduate of SDSU. Bob is in charge of the boating unit at the Lifeguard Service. He's got so many skills, I can't think of all of them. In addition to that, he is a Southern California representative on a Homeland Security resource team, where any time it consists of lifeguards, police, firemen, I don't even know who else, where there's team in Southern California, where if there's an incident anywhere in the United States, this team is ready to deploy. It could be floods, it could be fires, it could be bombs, it could be anything. They're highly trained, skilled. Bob was one of the leaders of the San Diego contingent that worked Katrina when flooding occurred. He's always off somewhere training with this Homeland Security team, and it's hard for me to keep up with everything he's done. My youngest son, Steve, is also a graduate of San Diego State, both a bachelor's and an MBA, works for a high-tech company here in San Diego, TriTech. He and a partner also have company they're developing on the side, in an entrepreneurial company that we're all in the family hoping is going to be brilliant because most of us are investors. So I have a great, great family.
And Jean.
We'll get to her. And I had started out with grandchildren.
Okay.
Harry's kids are Alexandra, who is in seventh grade.
Alexandra.
And Harry. We have too many Harrys in the family. Whenever we all travel together, we screw up our reservations because airlines always think they have duplicates and drop one or more of us off.
Huh?
Harry is in fifth grade. He's at Fuerte School. These two kids are very special. They both several times scored perfect tests on the state math tests. They both won national awards in something called the Word Masters program that's administered nationally, in which they are tested three times a year. And they have to look at words and choose among various selection other words which are the closest match to the word given to them. And they show me the tests, and they do better than I do on them. And I have a new grandchildren. Well, he just turned three. He's my son Robert's son. We're just really getting to know him. One nice thing we do as parents, Jean and I are grandparents, we haven't started with Robert yet, but we have a condo on the Big Island in Hawaii, and Jean and I take the other four grandchildren over there for the summer, and we run what we call Camp Albers, which is a rigorous program of academics, swimming laps, hiking, playing tennis.
That's fabulous.
And everything else to knock the energy out of the kids so Jean and I can survive. But it's a great experience for us, and we stay very involved with them, picking them up from school. And they're always at our house. And that's my main profession and Jean's main profession. Jean is also a graduate of SDSU in health science, and she's also a nurse, and she's an amazing woman and the love of my life.
What a beautiful, beautiful story. Wow. There's so much. I've just been enchanted by your sharing it, and I am so appreciative. We all are so appreciative. I mean, you've played such an important role at the university, but also the models that you innovated, it's mind-boggling.
Yeah, well, I hope it didn't come across as bragging, because
not
you do
at
it
all,
with
but it's
lots of people.
It's just so marvelous, and we want to thank you for sharing today, and it's a great contribution.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it. Thank you, Susan.